Toyota goes after the Miata, Lamborghini builds a street-legal fighter jet, a car crash sells for $72 million, and Carrie finally joins us for some fun. All that and so much more coming your way right now.
It's time to cruise the highways and byways of the auto industry's past, present, and future. Join us in exploring the vehicles, people, events, and places that have shaped the way we move. This is the Drive History Podcast.
Good afternoon and welcome to another episode of the Drive History Podcast. This is Brian Corey, joined as always by Jordan Stead.
Hello, my friends.
But fellow auto enthusiasts, we have a special guest with us today, introducing to you the man, the myth, the legend, our good friend, Mr. Kerry Rose.
Greetings and salutations. I exist.
He exists. You've heard his name. We've referenced his ideas. Yes. We finally drug him on here. How's it going, Kerry?
You drug me on. You didn't drug me on, but no, it's going well. I'm stoked to be here. Greetings to all you fellow car nerds out there.
Kerry, give us a reason why you should even be on here. Like what's parked in your driveway?
What's
previously been parked in your driveway?
We'll start with the vehicle that gets the most use these days that's parked in my driveway is a Chrysler Voyager.
I'm already jealous.
I know. Yeah, strong start.
Of course, Brian's jealous about that.
Man, there's going to be a lot of minivan love.
You didn't respond to my email about the 1 of 50 PT Cruiser Route 66 edition.
I did. I said we need to throw an air mattress in the back of that and literally cruise Route 66 with it. Oh, that would be perfect. It's meant for that.
I think we have now just discovered exactly why Kerry is on this podcast today. If you hadn't picked up on that story, that's exactly why he's here today. Kerry is a longtime friend of ours. We went to school with him. We hang out with him. We do all the things with him. He's also what I would consider to be the gateway drug of car friends, at least for myself. He's not only someone who shares an equal passion and an incredible amount of useless knowledge like we all have about cars, but he's also the person who's owned a zillion cars and has a similar thought process around spending money on cars, particularly shitbox cars and sub $10,000 cars. And he's also the person that's responsible for me somewhat unwillingly getting my motorcycle license, which I promptly got and then never rode a motorcycle again.
Wait, I have to interrupt really quick.
Yeah.
Just real hard hit, quick question. What is the most you've ever spent on a car?
The most I've ever spent on a car was actually for the 2002 Mustang that is in my garage right now that I spent $8,200 on that, something like that.
Bam. Jordan, how about you?
$27,000 on a new BRZ.
Oh, you went for it. Oh, I don't think I remembered that.
Me neither.
Yeah.
I blacked out.
I topped out at 11 with the Baja, so.
There you go.
You cracked that $10,000 ceiling, man. I have yet to do that. That's my weird line in the sand, hard cutoff. I don't know why.
Again, another reason why you're on this podcast today. It makes complete sense. We're all living in the same weird parallel universe together. Kerry, if you can, talk us through just at least some, if not all, of the automobiles that you have owned. And you don't have to go into the motorcycles, but you can if you'd like. But you've had such a stable over the years, and it's really kind of insane. So go ahead and let people know, really, numerically, why you should be on this podcast today.
Sure. There's at least 12 reasons is the main thing. Actually, I'm kind of 15, depending on your definition here. Okay, here we go. We'll do a lightning round. 1988 Volvo 240 sedan.
Sick.
1979 Volkswagen Westphalia camper. It was an automatic. Terrible idea. 1980 Datsun 210 hatchback.
Ooh, give us the backstory. Give us the after story on that one. Give us the 30-second rundown of what happened to that car.
The 30-second rundown was got that car for free from my girlfriend's at the time's dad. We fixed it up together. It started repeat braking. So I was starting to fix things multiple times and I didn't want to dive any deeper into what the causes were. So I was like, I can sell it. I've had it for a while and I'll get something else. And then I ended up selling it to a guy who I thought was a normal human being, but he wasn't. And then a couple years after I sold it to him, he ended up shooting a police officer in the face with a shotgun on Halloween in Seattle and used my Datsun as a getaway car. And the Datsun was actually the sole reason they tracked him down. because it is a terrible getaway car in every sense of the word. It
was just going to say that he could have chosen anything else, basically.
Pretty much.
The Voyager
would have done well.
The Voyager would have been great.
Yeah, there were basically two remaining Datsun 210s in that color in the state that had not rusted into a pile.
That's unreal. What came after the Datsun?
After the Datsun was a 1991 Ford Escort GT.
Sick.
That is, I'm not ashamed to say, that is still, at least in my rose-tinted glasses, that's my favorite car that I've ever had. After that, 83 Mazda RX-7, 1990 Honda Civic Sedan, 95 Mazda MX-3, four-cylinder, not six, not as cool, but more reliable. 91 Ford Ranger, 87 Jeep Comanche, truck phase.
Yeah.
1998 Acura Integra sedan. I had that for 4 years. That was the longest I'd ever had a car up until that point. And that was an amazing vehicle. I love that car.
More like a Type Gnarly.
It was so good. Then I had a 1995 Chevy G10 cargo van. If you can picture a free candy van, it was one.
I had one too.
Oh my God. I love that van, but you can't. It fits in certain neighborhoods, I guess we'll put it that way. And then currently, yeah, I've had this 2002 Mustang GT for 4 years next month, actually.
Wow. Look at this. These are like, you're breaking in big numbers here with that thing.
I know. I'm growing up. It doesn't feel right. But the Mustang is... No. Not based on the way I drive that Mustang, that's for sure.
I made this note to myself as we were introducing you, because I knew you'd get to the Mustang. Describe what the Mustang mindset is for you, because I have been in the car with you as you've driven the Mustang, and I have also driven that Mustang. And I feel like there's a perception of what it's like to own a Mustang, and there's the reality of it. And I don't think they're that different, but you tell me otherwise. Like, what is the Mustang mindset for Kerry?
The Mustang mindset was, I wanted to find the most reasonably affordable way to have a V8 and a stick shift in my life before they were both, if not outlawed, if they became so rare as to be, you know, unobtainium. And I think, Jordan, actually, you sent me an article. The title alone was, "My Mustang is Making People Think I'm an Asshole." And that kind of sums it up. Like, I have not modified this Mustang very much, but it is the stock exhaust. It is loud. If you're shifting, you know, the shifter is basically like, it feels like you're driving a truck. The clutch, you might as well be doing, you know, one-legged lunges. With the
sounds
clutch,
like a because real it's, pleasure.
It's a cable operated clutch. It is like driving the world's fastest, smallest full size pickup in terms of feel. It's very strange, but it's unsophisticated. It is super fun. And just the sound, you know, having that V8 sound, like every time I think about replacing it, I think about how I'm going to miss that sound most of all.
It's an incredible vehicle. And it made me appreciate Mustangs more than I ever thought that I would. I mean, I don't know why I wouldn't. It does sound unbelievable. And it's weird how good it sounds and how loud it is for how stock it is. It doesn't make any sense. I don't get it. I could swear that there is an aftermarket exhaust on that thing. I still kind of think there is, but there isn't.
No. I've crawled underneath. I've done a bunch of work on that car. It's the GT Premium. I think it's, you know, it's got the higher end. I think there was like an optional exhaust that I'm pretty sure they put on it, just from the factory. But yeah, you know, you just have to accept it is not a comfortable car. It's, you know, a 2002, so it's not what most people think of as the most stylish, but it is just the right side of practical enough. I've got this minivan for my day job, and the Mustang is like the perfect second and or fun car.
Interesting you should mention that. We didn't touch on your motorcycles, but you are an avid motorcycle rider with great taste and have experienced bikes from 125s all the way up to 1000s and beyond. And it's really something to behold. But the reason why I'm bringing this up is because going back to how I had mentioned that really you and our good friend Sam Spencer were both big moto riders at a time, and you both still are, but I was curious, and I had always kind of wanted to get my motorcycle license without really having any interest in motorcycles. Like, I just kind of wanted, it was one of those things where I told myself, I just want to do this thing. I want to achieve this like certification, or I want to learn this thing. And you guys both taught me how to ride and let me ride bikes. And I went and got my endorsement, and obviously still have it, but I got my endorsement, never sat on a bike again. But it's funny you mentioned this two-car solution, because here we are all the time agonizing over Facebook Marketplace, two-car, perfect two-car solution, perfect one-car solution. Well, dear readers, dear listeners, dear friends, maybe I'm just affected by the fact that it's 70 degrees outside today, but lately I've been thinking, why two cars when you could have one car and a motorcycle? Because a motorcycle solves a lot of the fun needs without having to even think about using it as a tactical, useful vehicle for anything else. And you can get them relatively quote unquote cheap. And obviously the gas mileage is incredible. And you can take it out and you can use it for 3 months out of the year, 6 months out of the year, and you can park it in the garage and not even think about it and not feel guilty about it, which is a problem I have with cars.
You don't even have to park it in the garage. You can put it in the living room.
This is true. Yeah, it could be just a piece of art. Yeah.
Been there, done that, although I think it's a stretch to call anything I've owned art. But yeah.
Anyway, I just like had that feeling the other day, and I texted Carrie and I thought, and I said, I think that I'm thinking about getting like a 400 sport bike, like something cheap, you know, 5+ years old, and just something cheap and fun that I can go and take out on back roads and be alone on, or ride with you and just be in the sun and then throw a cover on it and don't even think about it for the 8 months out of the year that it's raining and dark and spooky otherwise in Washington. And so this is the Carry effect is what I'm getting to here. It's like these things come and go, but he haunts you. He haunts you in different ways, automotively, motorcycle wise. So
that's
yeah.
why he's here.
It's true. It's true.
I'm here. Yes. Here to haunt the listenership. Apologies in advance.
All right. Moving into a little bit of news. Now that we've clearly shown why Carry should be on this podcast, all the reasons, let me count the ways. Two topics today, and we're not really going to cover the news, but we're going to just do a little bit of hot taking here about the news. The first thing is I've been seeing all these reviews of automotive journalists riding in the new Ioniq 5N, the Hyundai, and the sort of resounding cry is that this is the answer for enthusiasts in EV cars. I won't go into detail here, but I think moral of the story is give yourself a quick Google, a YouTube, whatever. You'll see all these automotive journalists testing this car and having a great time because of two big things. One, the car has sound internally that makes it sound like an internal combustion car. It has the sound of gears. It has a kickback of shift, the feeling of shifting. It even has a rev limiter sound when you're hitting a theoretical idea of the top of a gear, even though it's an EV. And not only that, is it's overpowered, it's good looking, it's a beautiful car. You can drift it, you can slide it, you can do all the fun things. It may be the ultimate one car solution, by the way. But the reason why I wanted to bring up this little piece of news is because I think my theory is right about why people like this car, particularly automotive journalists. I'm curious to hear what you guys think. I think that the reason why people are resistant, at least from an enthusiast standpoint, for enthusiast cars with EVs, is that sound is really the most important thing. I'm literally going to bring this back to a caveman era type thing, right? When we drive a fun automotive piece of art that is internal combustion, the sound is the payoff, right? It's this gratifying thing that we have control over and we can modulate and we can hear it and we can almost, you know, we can feel it, right? You can feel the sound, especially in Carrie's goddamn Mustang. It's kind of like this caveman brain thing for me, where it's like, car makes sound, car is good. Car don't make sound, car is not fun. And I kind of feel like even though it has all this fun stuff, the Ioniq 5N really is just about making you feel sonically that you're in a car. And that's actually most people's problem of adopting EVs if you're an enthusiast. How do you feel?
I will just say this. I have to disagree with you on the sound thing, just from a standpoint of the type of car enthusiast that I am. I like old cars. I like big, slow cars for a whole different reason. I enjoy driving them. I enjoy driving my 1949 Plymouth, but I enjoy it for the fact of like what it is, that I appreciate the history of it. Honestly, the slowness of it and the like simplicity of it. I'm not out there just like trying to like do burnouts and slide around corners. I'm just enjoying the drive. However, I completely understand what you're saying from like somebody who's my age and probably should be into like more modern enthusiast activities. Given this particular vehicle, It sounds kind of like the Ken Block e-tron. I didn't read anything about this, but right, Ken Block did, before he passed away, they built those Audi e-trons to have like the gear shifting and be able to slide them around corners. And I think Hyundai's getting after that a little bit with this.
I'm kind of a split between you guys a little bit, where I find sound to be very, very important, but it's not everything. However, you know, especially for example, with an old, you know, probably your Plymouth, Brian, and you know, certainly with this old like G10 van, we were just talking about that you had one of those too. Like that had a big old lazy V8 in it. I loved the sound of that thing, even when I'm driving 15, 20 miles an hour. I just like that thrum that it's got, that really kind of guttural sound that just fills the it's a metal drum, so it fills the van. But that is always something that I personally am looking for with vehicles, especially motorcycles too. You know, I've gotten rid of motorcycles because I didn't fall in love with them, and I'm convinced it's because I didn't like the sound as much as other options. So that said, the sound is also something that it's almost like an indicator of authenticity in a weird way. And so while I have trouble imagining that I could be as into this Ioniq 5N as some of these journalists are, my perspective is like, I am so glad that they did it and that they're trying it and that people do love it. Even if it's not going to be for me, I think it's about time someone tried doing something like this with an EV and thinking outside of the box. Because to go a little bit further, all these new EVs, there's so little to differentiate them anymore. There was already getting to be this point. If you didn't have an enthusiast internal combustion car, you know, if you drive any, you drive an Accord, you drive a Camry, you drive my Voyager, all new internal combustion cars are similar and refined and quiet and isolating. And EVs are even more so. So the fact that they just went over the top, like, you know, screw going to 11, they went to 20 on this. You can dial in different engine sounds. You can dial in all these things. And like Jordan, you were saying, I've watched the videos. Those electric motors will shake the car back and forth even while you're at speed, making it feel like you're overrunning, or, you know, when you let off the gas, it feels like you have a clutch engaged and your engine braking. Super, super cool and fascinating that they did that. I don't know if it's for me, but I'm just so happy it exists to kind of expose the EV faithful to this sort of thing.
Totally.
Yeah, well, not even to the EV faithful. I mean, I think, you know, from an enthusiast standpoint, they're aiming at a very specific demographic of buyers. And it'll be interesting to see how it's received, to be honest. I don't know that it's going to be like this big, like, woohoo, it makes noise sort of situation. But I think it'll attract more people than a Tesla. I mean, yeah. And you can buy a kit to make your Tesla sound like that too. You know, that's the thing. It's all artificial. And so it's like people are going to have a hard time getting over that hump because they just think that Hyundai's making it sound cool. But that doesn't mean that it is cool.
Totally. And the funny thing is also, you know, I've heard there are speaker companies now that are effectively making quote unquote aftermarket exhausts for EVs.
Yeah.
It's basically bolting 6x9s to the outside of your car. I think, that is the stupidest shit I've heard.
No, I agree.
And I have a hard time, but you know, I can totally acknowledge, I have a hard time squaring, I think that's dumb, with, I think the Ioniq 5N is kind of a neat thing.
Where does the new Dodge Charger fit in the middle of that? Because that also has sound. And I don't know about these other components that you're talking about, but there's a EV version that has exhaust notes, so to speak.
Well, and see, that's sort of, this is the interesting part that I guess does go beyond my caveman theory, which basically we've proved here that I'm just a caveman, really, at the end of the day. But like having an internal in-cabin sound in EV is not new, right? Like almost everyone has it, especially if you know, any, like the Mercedes all have this weird sound, Rivians, they all have them. I think what the Ioniq 5N is doing is not only is the sound more convincing and mimics gears, but they have also designed tactile feelings in the car that also can join with that sound. So that's what's really
that's interesting
to me. Yeah. Like, it's kind of like if you like a racing sim, then you'll love this. Basically, you just have to remember that you're actually on a real road. And you can actually kill someone in this racing sim. But the other interesting part about this is they already make an Ioniq 5. right? And it's a great mm-hmm. car. So you could go out and buy an Ioniq 5 and be completely fine. But the people who will seek this car out are people who literally want everything out of that Ioniq 5, but they still are literally buying it and paying extra money for this fake experience that makes them feel a certain way, which is just a very unique and interesting thing.
We already live in an artificial world.
This is true.
We do.
Yeah.
I will say a quick hot take too. I think the Charger, the electric Charger, would have been a lot cooler if they just hadn't made that stupid video.
Bro. Yeah. Probably.
Like it has primed me to hate that car.
Totally.
Which is a shame because the Charger, even the internal combustion one, you can have opinions about whatever the people that drive it or whatever. But it's like that was an American sedan with a big old V8 that they made for a long time, and it's a fairly robust platform. So it's like they've got some history, even modern history, where it could be cool. But God, that video where they just tried the hardest out of any human being ever. And it was so bad.
I think we've spent four episodes talking about this.
All right.
But you know what? They deserve it. Honestly, I'm going to bring it up every episode just to make sure that nobody forgets. Anyway, good stuff. One more exciting thing from the news side of things. We're going to kind of dip into the rumor mill for a second, which, if we were real journalists, we wouldn't do this, but we're not. So we get to do whatever the fuck
I got my degree.
Yeah, me too. Actually, we all do.
We literally all have degrees and we're all just like,
journalism.
We don't need that shit anymore.
That's right. Well, fuck that noise. Here's a fun rumor. So, there's a lot of heat right now on the old internets about how Toyota's would-be Mazda Miata rivaling convertible sports car could be reborn. And this is from Motor Trend. The confusing part here is that this model is called the SFR, which is very closely related to the FRS, which Toyota already made. So just try to keep that separate in your mind. But
small front engine rear wheel drive.
Is that for real?
Yeah.
Wow.
As opposed to
front engine,
rear wheel drive and smallish.
Yeah. Subcompact.
Okay. Yeah. Well, anyway, let's put it this way. In terms of a rumor, this is like one of the more exciting rumors in a while for me. It's basically, it's a Miata competitor. And there's a outlet called Japan's Best Car. If they can be believed, Toyota's dusted off this 2015 concept for this car called the SFR. And it's this collaboration between Daihatsu and Suzuki. And it's this beautiful two-door sort of bulbous, weird, rounded, fun, cute, but also somewhat menacing looking little rear-wheel drive.
It reminds me more of a Honda S2000 than a Mazda Miata.
The way to describe this car, which is a great three-car combo to combine it, is it looks like a TVR, I think they're called Tuscans. Remember those? Like with the crazy, weird, like multi-headlight things. In some ways, a little bit of a Honda Del Sol in the rear lights, mm-hmm. and then an Alfa Romeo 4C. Mixed with a Miata and an S2000. So obviously that's a 5 for 5. You can't really go wrong there, but it's such a beautiful looking car. And there's I read somewhere that there's a rumor on a rumor that this is a sub $30,000 two-door manual rear wheel drive roadster. And man, if it is, I'm in. And the real standout thing that's in this rumor is that it's going to have the 1.3 liter turbo under the hood. And I was thinking to myself, what is exciting about this car aside from the obvious? And really, again, caveman brain over here, I think it's the boost. I think it's the fact that it's a two-door rear wheel drive manual car that has the ability to be tuned, right? The BRZ and the 86 are awesome, fun cars everyone loves. But at the end of the day, you kind of buy them and they're kind of that, right? There's no extra work you can do unless, of course, you go out and you buy a turbo kit or a supercharger and you go wild or you do a V8 swap. That's not what I mean. I mean, what can you go out and buy, if this comes out, that has a turbo on it in this respect, aside from maybe the Fiat Abarth 124 Spider that we've mentioned before, which I don't even know if they make that anymore. But anyway, Like, this car is so beautiful, and it like has the tuning scene and like the enthusiast scene written all over it. And let's just hope and pray this thing comes out.
Absolutely. Yeah. A couple of things too, which is, this is the car. This is the ultimate version of, you know, the audio enthusiast screaming, we want this car. And then it comes out and all of us are like, cool, I'm just going to wait till it gets used and I can buy it for under $10,000. But you know, this is one of those cars that I really look at and I think, man, I could that be my first car payment car? Like, I look at it and I'm like, yeah, maybe. Like, that really, and I think you hit the nail on the head, Jordan. I was kind of reading these notes, TVR Del Sol Alpha, and you look at it and it's like, yeah, no, I can see that. And also for me as a guy, I've always really appreciated cars. I haven't done like an absolute monstrous amount of modding in my time. I'm usually just more like maintenance and repair and stuff like that, because I buy cheap crap boxes that I just need to fix all the time. Until you got your Fiat 500 Abarth, where, you know, that really opened my eyes to the ease of which you can tune some of these engines and the kind of fun and excitement that comes from that. The only thing I'm not stoked on is someone needs to like waltz into Toyota, and whoever's in charge of naming their things, they just need to slap them across the face, because you've got FRS, now you got SFR, and they've got this collaboration with Subaru. The Subaru has a Solterra EV crossover. Not a bad name, Earth, Sun, Earth, whatever. But the Toyota equivalent is the BZ4X, which is but got to be the worst car name I've ever heard. And everyone online just refers to it as the Busy Forks, because it's easier to say.
I like that too.
But it's just like, who the... It stands for Beyond Zero 4x4, by the way.
Oh my God, get bent.
But anyway.
Beyond Zero 4x4.
Yeah, or four-wheel drive. Or all
Beyond Zero what?
Beyond Zero, it's supposed to be Beyond Zero emissions, I'm sure. Or something. Oh my God, like that.
I'm asleep because with boredom.
It has more than zero emissions?
Beyond, not more than what zero. It's beyond zero. It's sort of,
is that more than or less than?
Well, that's the thing. I don't know. We're gonna probably have to ask some physicists about that or some mathematicians. But
and Neil, that is another reason why it's a terrible name. Not only is it a terrible name, but the name itself ruins its own name when you dig into the meaning of it. So yeah.
I don't
anyway,
remember what we're talking about anymore.
I know. Anyway, the moral of the story here is go do some Googling and check out this potential Toyota SFR concept. It looks amazing. It's quite literally
a dream.
Is there
a petition they can sign so that it gets made?
We can start one on this podcast right now.
It only costs $1 to sign up.
That's right. Keep an eye on the socials. We'll get a petition going to get this thing made. Anyway, let's launch into some history. Brian, what do you got for us this week?
Oh my gosh, guys. This week we're going through May 14th through May 20th, and we're starting off in 1969. The very last Chevrolet Corvair is built after 9 years on the market. The Corvair being Chevy's response to the Volkswagen Type 1, aka the Beetle, with an air-cooled rear engine vehicle that could also be had not only as a coupe, but a sedan and a wagon. I think what's most interesting about this car is the response that it got in Congress, thanks to Ralph Nader. This is really one of the reasons that there's like any sort of automotive safety developments in the 1960s. Mm-hmm. Have you ever read that book by chance, Unsafe at Any Speed?
No.
I have not. I have thought about it. I've thought about reading it because I've also thought about buying a Corvair. And I was like, maybe I should just know what I'm getting into from Ralph Nader's perspective.
Yeah. They did a lot of testing, and it turned out most of what he said was not right anyway.
Right.
But
nice job, Ralph.
It actually promoted more sales, I think. People are like, cool, a fun car. This was a fun car in the 60s.
It's amazing dangerous. How that happens, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you know, this is one of those cars, too. I mean, if you just look through some of the other history on this thing, if you kind of dig past Mr. Nader, it won, you know, a Car of the Year award when it came out. It was actually quite technologically innovative. You could get it has a flat six turbo at the end of its life with 170 horsepower.
Right. It was an SS version, or what did they call it? Was it an SS version?
It was effectively an SS, but I can't remember exactly what the trim level was, but yeah, you could get it with this flat six turbocharged Monza. It was the Corvair Monza.
That's what it was. Yeah.
And they're just if you want a classic car these days, they're actually a pretty good option because you can still get parts because of Ralph Nader. They're not super expensive and they're gorgeous cars. They are really pretty. And Brian, I mean, if you're going to buy one, you have to get the panel. You have to get the van version. They made a van.
Right. There's a van and a truck. Have you guys happened to see the new Jerry Seinfeld Pop-Tart movie?
I've only seen bad things about it.
God, I hated that sentence. Really? That sentence you said just pissed me off.
Oh my gosh. Yes. You got to watch the movie. If anything, for the cars. It's a Jerry Seinfeld movie. So, but he drives a Corvair wagon in the
movie. Okay. Well, that just redeemed it. So I need to start looking at other corners of the internet then, clearly.
Oh my gosh, just get a Netflix subscription. All right, so we were just talking about Toyota, and we'll jump ahead to May 14th, 2015. Toyota and Mazda released a joint statement announcing a partnership with the long-term goal of, quote, building appealing cars that meet the diverse needs and tastes of customers all over the world. And I don't know to the extent that that partnership exists today. I'll give a little more detail shortly. But going back to that FRS, whatever letter combination this new little roadster is.
SFR.
SFR. It seems a little bit counterintuitive to that partnership if Mazda's still building the Miata and Toyota's trying to swoop in with this little thing.
Yeah, I don't understand. Is this partnership like they're going to build cars together, or they're just saying like apart we're going to like work together in parallel to make cool shit?
Well, I'll say this. So Mazda Toyota Manufacturing is something that came out of the dealer or out of the partnership. It's a Huntsville, Alabama production facility that was built in 2018, and now they produce 300,000 cars there, but they build the Toyota Corolla Cross and the Mazda CX-50 there concurrently. So I don't know that they're working together to create something, or they're just financially assisting each other in terms of their output.
Weird.
Yeah. It's interesting. Yeah. I would be interested to dig into that even more, because it sounds almost like a less involved version of when Toyota basically said they were going to help GM get their stuff together with lean manufacturing and things like that. Cause they had when they had all the Geos, captive imports and things like that. And a lot of those were actually manufactured in, I believe they were manufactured in this side of the Pacific Ocean rather than in Japan. So I'd be curious to see that, but, yeah, if they're putting out Corolla Crosses, those are supposed to be perfectly fine crossovers, and the CX-50s are supposed to be perfectly fine crossovers for diverse customers, I suppose.
I like that CX-50, to be honest with you. That's like just the lower, wider, almost wagony version of the CX-5, right?
Yes.
Yeah, I like it. It looks good.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. I think Mazda's lineup has gotten kind of confusing. But yeah, I do like the CX-50 generally.
We've said it before, but Mazda styling, I think it's still on point.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. Can't argue there.
Yeah. The Mazda 3 hatchback, too, is so sick. It's such an underrated design, and I don't see a lot of them around, like the new Mazda 3 hatchbacks, but God, they're just like, oh, they're so nice. If they would have made that with a manual, I think that would have been like the enthusiast car of the last couple of years for sure.
Yeah, you could get it with a manual, but only with the base engine and only front wheel drive, I believe. But they, you know, they had they had a turbo and then an all wheel drive that they made automatic only. But I think they were pushing up market. I think they really nailed, a premium look and feel without actually charging quite as much as you might expect. So, yeah.
Can you imagine if they would have made that like a stick and a turbo and an all wheel drive?
It's interesting why they don't create these kind of combinations. They know they'll sell, but they'll only sell like six of them. Yeah. Yeah. Right.
Yeah. I know. It's more one out for the Mazda Speed 3.
Speaking of speed, May 15, 1997, Nissan announces that it'll sell the Skyline GTR outside of Japan for the very first time, with the model going to the United Kingdom. It's interesting because they had been building the Skyline since like the 50s. And it's, I think the Skyline, not GTR versions, were sold elsewhere, obviously. So this is GTR specific. And the UK version had the same drivetrain as the JDM version with the RB26 twin turbo inline six. And it was all wheel drive, I believe. They only intended to sell 100 of them in the UK in an entire year. And at the time, they were £50,000 in 1998, which would be about £115,000 today, which I don't know what that is in US dollars.
But. That's the weirdest like financial sentence that I've read in this podcast.
Well, you know me with my long strewn out factual statements.
Hey, it's better than me and my non-factual statements.
Happens to the best of us.
I did a quick conversion. What's $143,000 or $144,000 is what 115,000 pounds is, at least today. You guys talked a little bit about Skylines on a previous episode, and I appreciate them, and I think they're cool, but they don't occupy sort of a massive space in my brain the way that I think they do for so many enthusiasts basically all over the world. And I'm not quite sure why that is. I certainly have nothing against them, and I think they're really amazing vehicles, but yeah, they've not.
I really think part of it is, sure. I mean, I think part of it is we are not exposed the same way to auto racing that a lot of the world is. And totally. The GTR was so dominant in like the early 90s and beyond. You know, that's how it earned the name Godzilla and all this. And for so many different cars, like people are like fanatical about this, that, or the other thing because it won this rally or won this world championship. And for us, I don't think that we have the same level of interest in this, the racetrack, perhaps.
Yeah.
We just want to have fun. And I could be wrong. Maybe you guys are super into it, but like, I don't pay attention to any racing, to be honest.
I feel like I should be into racing. I should be into this, but for some reason, it's just not something that I spend a lot of time following.
It's more fun to drive cars than to watch them.
It's a lot more fun to drive than to watch. This is very true.
That's true. And I also feel like a little bit of a connection to this is, you know, ultimately we're cheapskates, right? Like we're cheapskate car enthusiasts. We want to have fun, but we don't want to fix cars. We don't want to buy new parts. We don't want to like buy new axles from breaking shit during a burnout. We don't want to track our cars so hard that we're just constantly living in hell with a broken car. And so I think that there's that too. We fit in what I believe to be probably a pretty large chunk of middle fat of enthusiasts, which are like people that like cars and appreciate cars. Maybe we'll buy a fun car, but we're not like crazy mechanics. We're not crazy dedicated. We're not trying to go on pedestals. We're not trying to win awards. We just want to have a good time in traffic every once in a while on the way to work. And we also want to maybe rip an Auto X 3 times a year with our buddies. I think that that's like a majority of car enthusiasts and like realistic car enthusiasts. And sure. So once you start getting into the racing that, you know, that Skylines were known for, I mean, those are like globally renowned racing situations, and they're expensive cars. They were expensive cars even then, right? So I don't know. They're beyond our sort of cheapskate car enthusiast mindsets. At least That's maybe where I'm coming from. That's kind of why I'm sitting where I'm sitting, I guess.
I agree with that. I did a Dirtfish day not too long ago. For those of you that don't know what Dirtfish is, that's another Google. It's a excuse to go to Google because there's a really wonderful, it's a rally instruction and course facility not too far from Seattle. It's in Snoqualmie. And I did that with actually a coworker of mine, and he started getting into this idea of like, yeah, we should really get a rally car. And so he knows this other guy. And this guy did his first rally with, you know, a Golf that had a cage and it had all this work done to it. And the guy sailed off the course at 70 miles an hour, and it was a 10G impact. Thank God the guy is fine, but the car is wrecked. And they can't even get the cage out, and the cage is like $4,000. And the only way to get that cage out would be to chop the roof off of this Golf. And so, and in addition to the fact that it needs axles, it needed an engine, it needs transmission, it needs all this stuff. And he's telling me all this. And I was like, you know, if I had nothing else to do,
yeah,
I can see it, but it's like, it's thousands of dollars, and it's, you know, it's so many hours. And if you're into it, more power to it, you know, absolutely respect. Racing is also an incredibly intense physical and mental sport. So yeah, if you're into it, massive respect. It's just not something that Jordan, I agree. We're just really not, our lifestyles don't revolve around it, frankly. Yeah.
May 16th, 1952, Studebaker and Porsche announced a development deal to create a concept car that combines the two brands. And it results in first a four-door Porsche 356. And there was four other concepts that followed, known as the Type 542s. The project stalled when Studebaker and Packard merged in the mid-1950s, but those four cars were never seen again. It makes me think maybe they're still out there, and I love automotive treasure hunts.
These cars are beautiful. It's a four-door Porsche sedan that also has this hint of 50s
Americana
yeah, built yeah. into it. Exactly. And one of the things I thought was interesting too, is this was, it's a front engine water cooled V6. And that's something that Porsche didn't do again for a long time until they came out with the 924. That was their first production water cooled car. So this was also really a technological platform to kind of them to show off what they could do too.
Yeah, it was a really interesting partnership in general. It stemmed from Max Hoffman, who is the reason that Volkswagen made it out of Germany, essentially. He was a Dutch importer-exporter, and he also developed the Volkswagen Type 2, like first person to sketch the van, did it on a napkin, handed it to whatever British general was running the factory at that point, and eventually it turned into the Type 2. But yeah, he had such a big play. He also did like the Mercedes 300 SL, like the Gullwing, like got them to turn that from a race car into an actual street legal production vehicle.
God bless.
Yeah, this guy really kind of shaped sports cars and the import market in the early 1950s.
Yeah, man. Not all heroes wear capes.
Have you guys heard of the Lamborghini Egoista?
No, but I have now. And my God, this thing is
insane.
Crazy.
When you look at it, I can't help but hear the name again.
Yeah, is it not like Egoista? Or like, I feel like it's Egoista or Egoista, or I don't know.
It's a strange name and a strange looking vehicle, but man, it's cool.
Well, the best part is that the name translates to selfish, which is amazing.
So the reason we're talking about it is because on May 16, 2014, Lamborghini announced that this one-off Egoista, whatever you want to call it, was going to live permanently at the Lamborghini Museum in Italy. And I just came across this and saw the picture, and it's pure fighter jet. It's a single seat car, which makes sense why it's called the Egoista, which, as you said, is selfish because it's just for one person. And you actually have to take the steering wheel off, and there seems to be a place where you have to set it for the cockpit to open, just like a fighter jet. So,
oh my God, so sick.
Right? It was designed by Walter De Silva, who was the head of Volkswagen design for a long time.
God, it's, you know what it looks like? It looks like the Lego set that you pick up as like a young kid that makes up a supercar. That's all it is.
It does.
It totally is.
It looks like a five-year-old drew a car and grew up and did drugs and like redesigned it.
Totally.
Redesigned what they had drew. It's like, it's absolutely bonkers. And that's, you know, those are the best Lambos, I think, are these just absolutely outrageous ones. It's such a cool thing.
Also, the ducting and the downforce on this is absolutely ridiculous. Like, I bet like the minute you hit 60 miles an hour, this car just plows itself into the ground because of the amount of downforce that it has going on. It's crazy looking.
It just starts dragging itself along the tarmac. Yeah.
Cool feature.
I think, yeah, you hit it on the head saying this is a Lego set. Like, it is wild.
Yeah.
It almost looks like, objectively, it looks dumb.
When I first saw it, I was like, no way that this is an actual Lamborghini. Like, what is this? What is going on here?
But, like, I can't say it's like a good design. It's just fucking insane, and that's why it's cool.
Yep, absolutely.
It's a kind of a crazy 50th anniversary celebration. That's why they built it. It was to honor 50 years of Lamborghini. And this,
you did it.
I don't know if they did. They should have at least put a V12 in it. That was what the first car had. It only got a V10.
That's weird. That is weird.
Oh,
that's awesome.
Yeah. Oh, man. What were they doing? What were they doing with that shrinky-dink 5.2 liter V10 with 600 horsepower? What a bunch of wieners. Put something else in there.
Wusses.
Yeah. Didn't they know that 800
Italian
horsepower
sausages,
is the new 200?
Yeah. Oh, my gosh. All right. Jumping forward. May 17, 1934, Gordon M. Buick filed a patent for the vehicle that would become the Cord 810. I had to leave this in here just to give you guys a quick history lesson. Also, because this was the first full classic car that I ever drove. Full classic being a very limited amount of cars that is recognized by the American Association of Classic Cars. The whole point is that there's a fine selection of vehicles that make their list. And this is one of them because of its rarity and its technological advancements. And so my uncle, who you met, Jordan, has one of these cars. And I think they only built like maybe 1,700 of them over 2 years, either in convertible two-door or four-door sedans. They came out with a supercharged version in 1937, which is what my uncle has. What's cool about them is they were the first vehicles to have hidden headlights. And they had a pre-selector transmission. You'd like shift into whichever gear you want to go in, then push the clutch. And it would feel almost like an automatic transmission where you didn't have to get everything right on time.
Brian, is there one of these at the LeMay Museum in Tacoma, Washington? Okay. Because I thought I'd seen one in person before.
They call them the coffin nose cords because of the insane grill.
If you can kind of think of every sort of roaring 20s into depressed 30s stereotype of over-the-top opulent styling, it's all wrapped up in this vehicle. And it is a gorgeous, imposing car. One of the other kind of cool things I thought about it too is it was the first front-wheel drive American car with an independent front suspension. And that wouldn't be redone until the Oldsmobile Toronado in the 60s.
Right.
Technologically, there's a lot going on in this car. And it's what a piece of history it is. It's just an absolute work of art.
Oh, it's so fun. And because it was front-wheel drive, there was no transmission tunnel, which allowed it to ride so much lower. And so if you look at any other car from the 1930s next to this thing, it looks like a sports car today.
You look at how high they were off the ground. They had to have running boards. I mean, basically the height and length of like today's full-size pickup trucks for some of these just cars, just because of the packaging constraints of what everyone was using at the time. So yeah, eliminating running boards. And also, I want to say the supercharged one that you said your uncle had, Brian, with like the exhaust pipes that are
aren't they gorgeous?
Come out of the side of the hood.
Yeah,
it's like that's just
and
so
that's
cool.
You know, that's the only telling sign that it's a supercharged car from the exterior. Like on a Subaru Baja, like mine, you have a hood vent or a hood scoop, and that's the way to tell.
It's such a sweet vehicle, and they were expensive, and so.
I love the divorced fenders. I think that's such like a cool design thing that probably just isn't even allowed anymore. But just like how the wheels sat within fenders outside of the car in such a unique way. So cool. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
There's a guy selling a hot rod, one of these in Monroe right now. I'm very tempted. It's only like 11 grand. I mean, it's like a complete rat rod. Like it's just a shell with a small block 350 in it. Okay, if there's something weird on here, do you guys like art?
No, hate art. I hate art.
May 17th, 2007, Andy Warhol's painting titled Green Car Crash sells at auction for $71.7 million, setting a record for any Warhol painting at the time. Just proving that it's impossible to turn away from a car wreck.
I see what you did there.
Local
$71 million of rubbernecking.
Yes. Yeah, right. And what's crazy is like the most expensive car ever sold is only about double that. And so you can have a painting to hang on your wall or a $150 million. I think it's a Mercedes race car from the 50s that sold for about $150 million in a private sale. So take your pick.
I love that the painting was inspired by photos of a car being pursued by Seattle police.
Right. Had to have the local connection.
Yeah. Oh God.
Anyway, I can't afford any art. Just kidding. We just started an art collection a little bit. I just bought a piece by the woman who developed the Cabbage Patch Kids. So come on over.
Right.
Yeah. She lives in Bellingham.
Of course she does.
She's also, like 94 years old.
Oh my God. Also, did you buy it for $71.7 million?
$71.2 million.
Nice.
Dollars?
Yeah. Cents. Yeah. Also, framing is really expensive. Just buy art that's already framed. This is now a home improvement blog. That's
true. It's a win-win-win. Yeah.
May 18th, 1958, Maria Teresa de Filippis becomes the first woman to drive in a qualifying Formula One event when she attempts to qualify for the Monaco Grand Prix. She did not qualify. But just later in the season, she qualified for the 1958 Belgian Grand Prix, finishing 10th. So shout out to Maria for becoming the first woman in F1.
Go hard.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think one of the things, actually, when I was looking at this too, Brian, that made me sad is I didn't realize, again, you know, not following racing quite so closely, it's so rare to have women in Formula One, to have women drivers.
Totally.
It was 15 years until another one. And then there's only, what is it? Three other women have since tried to enter a Formula One race, albeit unsuccessfully. Like, why? You know, we've got women astronauts. We've got women athletes. It's like, you know, I'm so astounded even, you know, in 2024 that there isn't more gender representation in Formula One. So I absolutely, it's just kind of astounding.
Yeah, I'm trying to find it right now, but I just read about a woman who got recruited by Williams F1 team for their like Formula 3 or something. So they're putting her on the track to see if she can get there. So
good, good.
Yeah, we're definitely in need of more of that. And that, I honestly think like racing is something that can be enjoyed by everybody at the same time. Like there doesn't have to be different divisions. It's just like, we're all on the track. We're all in the same car. We're all going fast. It's just a skill-based thing.
Yeah. And you know, one of the times that Jordan and I did autocross up in Bellingham, I brought my girlfriend, my partner of 8 years, and she's driven my Mustang on a track. And she's always blown away that there's just not a lot of female representation. There was one woman working at that track for the Chuckanut Sports Car Club, who was also just an absolute badass, but she did a great job at, you know, representing women and making people feel welcome. And she was, you know, walked up to Mulaney and was like, Mulaney is her name, is my girlfriend's name. I'm not just saying my lady. but, you know, it was just great that they, you know, it made Mulaney also kind of feel more included there. So, you know, we really do need to elevate women in motorsports and to elevate women in car culture, I think is a really important thing.
And you mentioned Dirtfish, and they actually do a really good job of that. And their marketing manager, Josie, she works closely with the car museum that I work at. And
very cool.
She's incredibly knowledgeable and apparently a pretty good driver from what I hear. So, yeah, we should go out there. We should go do some laps out of Dirtfish sometime.
Oh, say no more.
May 19th, 1903, Buick is founded as a subdivision of Buick Auto Vim and Power Company, an internal combustion engine builder. Their first cars, the Model B, would launch the following year with just 37 of them rolling off the assembly line. Wasn't really an assembly line then, coming out of the factory that year. So based on Buick's founding date of May 19, 1903, it's the second oldest American automaker behind Cadillac. But if you consider that the original company was founded in 1899, Buick is the oldest operating American car company.
I did not know that. That's crazy.
Have you any favorite Buicks?
I mean, I could see Jordan nodding, and I was thinking too, like, you know, my mental image of Buicks are
Roadmaster.
Not even that. It's like a 98 Park Avenue sedan.
Yeah, for sure.
Full size sedan. However, I mean, but you know, to be fair, if you don't know what like a, you know, a Buick Skylark is, it's, you know, kind of an old school muscle car, a 60s, 70s muscle car. Those are absolutely cool. And the one that actually that I always think of with Buick, because I'm a special breed of nerd, is the Buick Riatta, R-E-A-T-T-A.
Oh, the little coupe, right?
It's a little it's a two-door coupe with a removable hardtop, I believe, on some models.
Yeah.
And it was one of the first cars that had a touchscreen interface. It was it was like the Apple II green color CRT that was embedded in the dash. And if it broke, you were SOL on so much stuff, but it was a really, it was kind of a neat, technological, tour de force at the time when it came out. I don't think it sold very well, but it's a cool car.
I would like to find one of those with a working touch. Or
they pop screen up every so often, and people, you know, there's people out there that can still repair CRTs. So those are not, you know, if it breaks, you're not necessarily all the way out of luck.
I'm actually surprised at how new Buicks are not very expensive.
Yeah.
I don't know if you check out like the new Buick Envista, it's pretty sweet, like a little crossover, but it's like 30 grand to start. And it seems like a really nice vehicle for what it is.
Well, yeah, Brian and other listeners of this podcast may have expected me to not have an answer to this question because I have dogged on Buicks and their only champagne color option for the last 14 episodes. But I have two good answers to this question, by the way. My first one is a new Buick, which I know we all like, which is the Buick Regal Tour X wagon.
Oh, hell yeah.
Correct. Very cool, low-key, very kind of sleepery, unknown, awesome station wagon that Buick made. 2.4 turbo. Yeah, and very cool all-wheel drive, like really good-looking wagon, honestly. And they're kind of underrated, and they're kind of hard to find. But when you do find them, they are way too expensive for what they are, in my opinion.
Like 20 grand if they have 130,000 miles on them still.
Yeah, yeah, get bent. And then my old cool Buick on the other side of things is the late 80s Buick Grand National Regal GNX.
Yep. You have to.
Yes, very absolutely cool. which I think is the coolest part about it. And this is sort of the everybody knows this, but it was a turbo V6 and it made over 245 horsepower, while a stock V8 in a Camaro at the time had 190 horsepower. So it just like stomped at the time.
Yeah. And it's funny too, there, it looks like it was basically underrated on purpose too. People would take them to a dyno and they're getting like 30, 40 more horsepower than even they were claiming, which is also just a added cool fact.
Car companies would do that so that they could underscore or undervalue the horsepower so that they could save on insurance and all these other sort of things.
Yeah, totally. That's when car companies really had our backs.
Yeah. May 19th, 2019, BMW launches the 640i Grand Coupe. Features a 315 horsepower twin power turbo six cylinder and electronically controlled top speed of 155 miles per hour. Started at 77 grand. So I was looking this car up. I just wanted to see what they were going for these days. You guys probably already read the notes, but what would you guess that a $77,000 BMW from 5 years ago would go for today?
I mean, I would have guessed easily less than half of the original value. There's no other way.
I was actually surprised too. I found one that had 40,000 miles on it and it was $34,000. And that just seems like a lot still for a used BMW.
Only 40,000. Oh, well, that's true. It is pretty new. Yeah. I love that design, by the way. Especially the front end of this design. Beautiful. The M6 of this era is pretty monstrous. I don't know. It's different. It's just kind of different looking. It's not my favorite design, but they're very imposing on the road. They look really cool, especially in black.
Yeah. I'm a little cold on this design. I don't know why. I think it's probably because I also hate when manufacturers call things, coupes and put four doors on it. It's just like,
right. Grand coupe.
Yeah, which is a fucking sedan. Sorry. Apparently I have really strong feelings about this.
You mean a grand coupe.
Grand coupe.
Grand coupon.
I guess my beef is the previous 6 series have always been infinitely cooler and looked cooler, I think. Facts. You had the Chris Bangle era 6 series, whether you like the Bangle butts or not. That was a fashion statement of some sort. It was a two door. And then you go back to, I believe it was the late 80s. You could get, that 635 CSI. And it's like the shark nose hood and everything, they just looked so much like the business, like those classic sporty BMWs. So the new one just looks a little too restrained for me, frankly, but I'm sure it's a nice car. If it still works after 40,000 miles.
May 19, 2021, Ford introduces the Ford F-150 Lightning, the company's first all-electric truck. I remember when this came out. It was such a big deal. People were making there was a lot of hype around it. I think I watched the factory release video that they got everybody queued up for. And I remember vaguely a lot of lightning bolts and a lot of people on the construction site powering their drills with it.
I'm not even going to comment on this. I'm just going to ask the question. Hey, listeners of this podcast, if you have a Ford F-150 Lightning, how are you doing? Are you okay? Because I feel like those were so hyped. They were really expensive. They came out. Nobody bought them. And then they dropped the price like a crazy amount. And I think it was mostly on behalf of the fact that they had a lot less range than people wanted out of them. And I've seen a number of them on the road, but I don't know. I feel like they're kind of going to be this forgotten e-truck.
Why do you think the Rivian sells so well when this doesn't?
I just don't think it worked. I think what they did was they did a great job of making an all-electric pickup truck look almost exactly like a regular pickup truck. And so then for what turned out to be vanishingly small overlap of manly men that like full-size pickups that also are really into EVs. As soon as you say it, you're like, right. Oh yeah, that's probably not a ton of people. Because Rivians, I just see it as a totally different market. I see it
totally.
As a totally different
Well, they tried to make this Lightning like a work truck. It's going to power your work site. It can power your house. It's a generator. It does all this and that. But it also, my theory that it didn't sell well is because it has a very small frunk. So.
insignificant frunk. Yeah. Yeah. I can get behind that theory as well. I mean, this is a whole nother topic in and of itself that I think it feels like everyone who's talking about cars across the internet is having is everyone went all in on EVs. And the only way manufacturers thought they could do it and make money was to build these ridiculous, expensive, heavy monstrosities. And then everyone that can afford them has bought them. I could, you know, take away my $10,000 line in the sand for a used car. It's like, I could afford a pretty nice car, but I just don't see the point of dropping 80 or 90K on a depreciating asset like that,
right?
Especially when the infrastructure for even replacing those battery packs, it's like, that's why the resale value is so bad on EVs too. You know, all the value's in the battery pack and it don't last forever.
I think we're hitting the nail on the head here on the F-150 for sure. The idea of it is very appealing, right? But the execution, the timing, the target market, or the lack of target market, I suppose, is I think what probably the downfall was. I'd be curious to know the sales numbers of it. And you're right about the Rivian. Like, the Rivian isn't even remotely in the same category, but you know what you're getting when you're buying a Rivian, right? You're probably buying it because of a lifestyle or because of a style choice, but it also happens to be an amazing truck, right? But it also, you're not going to haul a bazillion pounds of gravel in it either. It's a weird thing. I'm curious to see how the F-150 Lightning will be looked at in the annals of automotive history.
When we do episode 4007, we'll know.
Yes, well, exactly.
And one final point about this too is you're so much of the people that buy full-size pickup trucks too, I think the idea is they customize them to express their individuality, and then what happens is they all end up looking the same, like bro-dozers. But the issue is you try to do anything on an electric vehicle, like say you just want to put new rims and tires on it, you destroy your range immediately. That's a crossover demographic that you just don't appeal to all of a sudden because it's just not practical.
Wham bam. Thank you, sir. May 20th, 1899. I had to have at least one 1800s fact in here.
Yes.
The first speeding ticket in the USA is issued. The vigilante Jacob German was driving an Electrobat taxi cab in New York City at a harrowing 12 miles per hour in a 4 mile per hour zone.
Oh my God.
He was driving so dangerously that the bicycle officer who pulled him over took him to jail.
I want to see that 100-year-old speed limit sign that says 4.
Right. It was for the horses, I'm pretty sure.
God, what a ridiculous meme of a paragraph that was.
Also, Electrobat.
Yeah, come on.
You know, people tend to forget that electric cars were much more common in the late 1800s and early 1900s than they were now, even.
Yeah, absolutely.
You could have an electric car, a gas car, or a steam car, and all of them were viable options up through the 1920s, even into the early 30s.
Mm-hmm. God, 12 miles an hour is so fucking slow.
The Electrobat is actually, it's capable of 20 miles an hour. So that guy really was, he was reining it in.
He was granny shifting that thing.
I wonder if he had a passenger. It was a taxi cab. Somebody was in a hurry to JFK.
Right.
Okay. Last but not least, May 20th, 1987, American Motors Corporation approved a deal allowing Chrysler to acquire it. This was one of the last great American acquisitions in the auto industry of this country. But more than anything, Chrysler wanted Jeep, which AMC owned. So it quickly killed off the AMC brand itself, such as the AMC Eagle, which RIP, such a great vehicle.
Oh, so cool.
And then they ended up sinking a lot of money into Jeep. And honestly, I think Jeep carries that brand, that segment today. Well, obviously, they're all under a whole different umbrella. But, you know, just prior to this, they had bought Lamborghini. They were really trying to get crazy over at Chrysler.
This is near and dear to my heart because of that. Like we said at the top of the hour, when I went through my lightning round of all the vehicles I've owned, I had a 1987 Jeep.
You don't have
Comanche.
To cry, man.
I miss that truck. I actually do miss that truck. I don't miss standing outside of Jordan's house on Queen Anne in Seattle, hitting my starter with a wooden stick.
You gotta know the tricks.
Yeah.
Now the question is, was it a pre-Chrysler 87 or a post-Chrysler 87?
I'm pretty sure.
I don't know. That's a good question. Now that you mentioned, that's funny. I didn't even think about that.
You know, I'm pretty, so I had the four cylinder and it was two wheel drive. So it was like the most poser Jeep of all poser Jeeps. And it was a four speed, but it had
pretty sick.
I'm pretty sure it had the Renault engine computer management system, which I always thought was going to be the end of me.
I forgot that Renault had like a stake in AMC, right?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah, there's, I think it was the Renault, it was because that engine was fuel injected in 87, which, you know, that was the small consolation to my starter issues. Jeep is basically still the cash cow for Stellantis, I guess, these days.
Stellantis?
Ugh. Yeah, it's a horrible name. It's just awful to say.
Yeah, it's like a condition.
It is. Yeah. I've got a bad case of Stellantis on the back of my legs right now.
Yeah. I mean, I've got a bad case of Stellantis. It's like you're just perpetually kind of running low on money.
Do you go to the doctor for that or the mechanic?
Yeah, both.
Yeah. Well, that does it for the history portion of this episode of the Drive History Podcast. But we got a very nice letter that I would like to share with the both of you and all of you listening in this afternoon or evening, or perhaps it's the morning. I must admit, I have listened to only 3 episodes of the podcast so far, the first 2 and the newest. I find the perspective of hearing history returning from a younger generation quite interesting and sometimes amusing as I close in on 3/4 centuries of a life. I seldom ever have had the chance to buy the car I wanted, both financially and practically, due to my job having me on the road most of the year and needing to take equipment with me. He goes on to say, now I drive an Impreza, which I know Jordan dissed this week. Way to go, Jordan.
Sorry.
But it is fun enough, and the lights allow me to continue to drive after dark. The newest episode, when discussing the cars of London, the luxury car predominance makes sense with the current high fees to drive in parts of London. The drivers of Toyotas can't afford those fees. But in the countryside, where I spend most of my UK time, you see all sorts of Mazdas, Coopers, Peugeots, Skodas, Fords, and more. Keep up the good work of getting automotive history into the mainstream. David Reese out of Pennsylvania. Thank you, David.
Yeah, that's a great letter. I can tell you're a worldly individual, Dave. I appreciate the note, and I apologize on trashing the Impreza. Although I wasn't really trashing the Impreza, I was trashing on how it's evolved. So unless you're driving a 2023 Impreza,
bite your tongue. I was just we're gonna get another email.
This is true. No, that's awesome. Also, this is very cool. That's a great point too about the London situation. That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. Just on the Impreza thing. Is it Impreza or Impreza? I don't know. Either way.
Tomato, tomato.
I'm taking Polish lessons via an app, and Impreza in Polish means party.
Oh,
so
it's the party mobile.
Yeah, I'm gonna assume that's where they got the name from. Anyway, gentlemen, this has been quite fun.
I appreciate you guys having me on. Thanks for letting me take over the mic.
We'll have a vote and let people decide if you should continue to be on the episodes or not.
Yeah, I was gonna say, and even if they vote no, it's guaranteed you're gonna be on future episodes. So, you know, dear listeners, we love you, but we don't trust you. So, you'll be back.
My only job is gonna be what I had to do at my previous job, which is ignore the comment section.
Love it. Love that. As per usual, folks, please give us a follow, give us a rate on wherever you listen to us, wherever you listen to podcasts. Follow Brian on his socials, which is
Spare Change Multimedia on Instagram, and of course, This Day in Automotive History on Facebook and on Instagram as well.
Follow me at Jordan B. Stead on most things. And Carrie, where can we follow you?
You can follow my occasional mishaps on Instagram at CarrieRose23, because there were 22 others.
But you're the best version of all of those Carrie Roses, so we love
it. So true.
Well, thank you all for listening. We appreciate it. This has been a very fun episode, and we will see you soon, aka very soon, aka next week. Thank you so much. And Brian?
Till then, drive history every day.
Bye.